Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Now, if you've been trying to tune into KNSJ lately on your radio dial and you're getting static, that's because the transmitter on Monument Peak near Mount Laguna has been iced over. We'll tell you just how much snow fell in our local mountains last week on today's show. On our Capitol Report, we'll have details on the President's State of the Union speech and the Democratic response. Plus, hear about grassroots efforts here in California to support a Green New Deal. And on Crime Beat, hear about some commercial burglars who were busted right here in East County. We'll also have news about a new bill by Assemblywoman Shirley Weber that aims to reduce police shootings. Learn about public hearings on school safety coming up in the Cajon Valley Union School District in East County. And on People Power, hear about some new comfort items donated to those Julian Cuyamaca volunteer firefighters. Plus, hear how SDG&E is working to help those recently furloughed federal workers who need help to pay their utility bills. We have a consumer alert today on luxury automobiles that have been bursting into flames. And on Destination East County, hear about all the most fun and festive happenings in our inland region, such as Celtic dancing, a Lunar New Year celebration, Black History Month events, and more. And finally, as we celebrate Valentine's Day this week, we'll be re-airing our bookshelf interview with El Cajon resident Amanda Matty, a local author who fell in love with an Iraqi translator and wrote about her experiences in her book titled Foreign Affair, A True Story of Love and War. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. 5 days of storms have turned our local mountains into a winter wonderland. Mount Laguna received a foot of snow, the National Weather Service reports. Snow also fell in Julian, Pine Valley, Descanso, and some other areas, dropping to less than 3,000 feet in elevation. The storm also doused much of the county with heavy rains, including up to 6 inches in some locations, helping to recharge reservoir water levels across our region. Now, if you're considering a trip to frolic in the snow, check current road and weather conditions, since tire chains may be required, and use caution on icy roads. For current road conditions, check the County Department of Public Works page on Facebook. The Laguna Mountain Lodge posts local weather conditions on its website at lagunamountain.com. There are also webcams available on the Laguna Mountain Lodge site and the UCSD HP Wren Cameras site. When driving in snowy conditions, it's a good idea to carry warm clothing and a shovel to avoid getting your vehicle stuck. Residents of mountain communities have asked us to remind everyone that while visitors are welcome to come enjoy the winter wonderland, guests are asked to please be respectful. Don't trespass or park on private properties, and be sure to pack out any trash with you to leave the area beautiful for everyone. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. During his State of the Union address, President Donald Trump spoke on issues ranging from the economy to immigration, also honoring the upcoming 75th anniversary of D-Day and three World War II veterans. One of those was Joseph Riley of Santee. Trump praised the men as incredible heroes. The president took credit in his speech for an improving economy and urged unity to avoid a future shutdown. He called for an end to what he called foolish wars and partisan investigations by Congress of his administration amid Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's ongoing probe. Despite calls for unity, Trump's speech repeatedly argued for funding for a border wall to divide the U.S. and Mexico. He cited San Diego's border barriers, calling for what he called a smart, strategic, see-through steel barrier, not just a simple concrete wall. The president has threatened to invoke a national emergency to build the border wall in order to keep out migrant caravans of immigrants seeking asylum. Stacey Abrams, a former gubernatorial candidate from Georgia and potential vice presidential candidate, delivered the official Democratic response. She faulted Trump for the shutdown and blasted Republicans for dismantling the Affordable Care Act, passing policies that hurt working people and the poor at the expense of tax cuts for the wealthy.
and criticized voter suppression tactics targeting minorities. Abrams concluded, "With a renewed commitment to social and economic justice, we will create a stronger America together, because America wins by fighting for our shared values against all enemies, foreign and domestic." The New York Times published a fact check of the President's State of the Union address. It found several false statements, including claims on the rate of economic growth and violence linked to immigrants. It also found numerous misleading statements on issues ranging from abortion to wage increases, as well as some true statements on tariff rates and military successes against ISIS. During the State of the Union speech, Private First Class Riley from Santee sat beside First Lady Melania Trump, whom he met at a commemorative event in Paris earlier. But Riley's views on some matters do not align with Trump's. Riley is a Democrat and longtime labor union volunteer who has been outspoken against divisive politics. After the State of the Union address, San Diego Supervisor Nathan Fletcher tweeted a video of Riley in uniform, delivering a speech in which the World War II hero stated, "I'm disappointed at some of the people in our nation that treat people differently because of the color of their skin, their ethnicity, or their religion." And he added, "We are a better country than that." Democrats brought guests of their own to the State of the Union address, including California Senator Kamala Harris, a Democratic presidential candidate. Senator Harris brought a furloughed federal worker who lost her home in a wildfire in Northern California, driving home her points on how the shutdown and cuts to FEMA funding have hurt Californians, including disaster survivors. The California senator also posted a video prequel to the State of the Union in which she stated, "The strength of our union has never been found in the walls we build. It's in our diversity and our unity, and that is our power." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Grassroots groups like the Sunrise Movement and 350.org are mobilizing across California and the nation this week and next to promote the Green New Deal, a 10-year plan to fight climate change by weaning the country off of oil and gas. On Thursday, Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts introduced twin resolutions in the U.S. House and Senate. Masada Diesenhaus with the group San Diego 350 says the U.S. and the whole world need to work toward net zero greenhouse gas emissions and fast.
The vision of the Green New Deal is really a massive program of public investment aimed at transforming the energy sector and the whole economy to create clean energy jobs and infrastructure, to decarbonize the economy, and to promote economic justice.
The Green New Deal calls for the U.S. to switch over to a national smart grid that relies on renewable energy sources like solar and wind. It asks government and private businesses to retrofit buildings for energy efficiency and for job retraining for people working in the fossil fuel field. Opponents argue that the policies would cost too much and be disruptive to industry. Green groups are asking for a state-level plan to phase out drilling in the Golden State. But Diesenhaus thinks the real potential is in the transportation sector because in Southern California, vehicles produce almost half of the emissions.
That will have to change, and that can be through combined efforts to increase transit, have more active transportation like walking and biking, and electrifying vehicles.
The Green New Deal also emphasizes environmental justice. Its backers point out that lower-income communities have been disproportionately harmed by pollution from drilling and refineries and by the floods and wildfires linked to climate change. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Crime Beat Report. Two serial burglary suspects have been arrested in Lakeside and Spring Valley. Authorities believe the men were responsible for over 30 commercial burglaries countywide, with losses totaling over $130,000. Detectives and crime suppression team deputies from Alpine, Rancho San Diego, Lakeside, and Santee served search warrants that led to recovery of property stolen from a business in Rancho San Diego. Those searches also found a clandestine marijuana growing operation and a butane honey oil extraction laboratory. Andrew Myers and Adam Nuno, both 34 years old, were arrested and booked into the San Diego Central Jail for commercial burglary and drug manufacturing possession of marijuana for sale.
Can a new law reduce police shootings? California lawmakers will soon be putting that question to the test, CalMatters reports. Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, a San Diego Democrat, is planning to reintroduce legislation that stalled last year after months of working with civil rights experts and law enforcement behind the scenes. The bill aims to prevent deaths such as the killing of Stephon Clark, an unarmed man shot to death last year in his grandmother's backyard after Sacramento police mistook a cell phone in his hand for a gun. His death set off protests nationwide, one of many killings of unarmed African Americans at the hands of white police officers from Ferguson, Missouri to San Diego and El Cajon locally. Attorney General Javier Becerra has released a review of the Clark killing, which urged the department to overhaul its use of force policies and expand de-escalation tactics, allowing force only when necessary. Many of his recommendations are expected to be included in the new bill for implementation statewide, if the measure is signed into law. Ronald Lawrence, vice president of the California Police Chiefs Association, acknowledges that police and communities have got to come together and make sure that trust is there. But he notes that many shootings could be avoided if people would comply with orders from law enforcement officers. It will prevent a lot of tragedies, frankly, he says. Police also want money for training officers and more access to psychiatric specialists and homeless services to handle calls for people who need help, but not necessarily from the police. Activists and civil rights advocates say trust will come when police are held accountable for killing. Making it easier to prosecute police, they say, will ultimately reduce unnecessary deaths. One reason why officers are rarely prosecuted is that the legal standard justifies using deadly force when a reasonable officer would do the same thing in the split second before firing. Last year's controversial bill would have changed that legal standard in California to justify shooting only when necessary, meaning only when other tactics such as warnings or de-escalation are not possible. Lizzie Buchan, a lobbyist with the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, says the law is too permissive. She says it gives very broad discretion to use force to kill people, even if officers have other options. The ACLU representative adds, "There's a pretty overwhelming perception by the public that police operate with impunity and that they can kill people without being held accountable." But police counter that officers are often targets of violence themselves. They say they need maximum legal protection to perform a dangerous job, and voice concerns over a law making it harder for them to shoot, saying it would make them more vulnerable to being killed. Davis police officer Natalie Corona, for example, was shot dead while responding to a traffic accident on January 10th. Brian Marvel, president of the Peace Officers Research Association of California, represents 70,000 police officers. He says 99% of the time officers are reacting to the way someone is approaching them. To sit here and say if I roll up on a scene that I have to use a taser, a nightstick, and go hands-on before I can use deadly force, you're jeopardizing public safety. Senate leader Tony Atkins, a San Diego Democrat who shelved last year's bill, responded to Attorney General Becerra's report by stating that she is working on Assemblywoman Weber's revamped bill with two guiding principles in mind, the danger and difficulty of police work and the acknowledgement that police shootings disproportionately affect communities of color. Senator Atkins concludes, "We do have a problem in this country and in this state, so we've got to make sure we get something done on this issue." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Jonathan Goetz with an education report. The Cajon Valley Union School District is hosting 6 public meetings on school safety. The district will share results of safety audits and recommendations from consultants that it hired. Participants will also talk with leaders from the El Cajon Police and Sheriff Departments on immediate and long-term steps to maximize security and safety on campuses for students, teachers, and staff. All meetings will be at 6 p.m. The meeting dates and locations are February 7th at Hillsdale Middle School, February 19th at Greenfield Middle School, February 27th at Montgomery Middle School, March 14th at Cajon Valley Middle School, March 21st at Emerald Middle School, and March 27th at Los Coches Creek Middle School. To attend, please RSVP to email at blackboard.com. The district also has a survey that meeting participants are encouraged to complete. Superintendent David Miyashiro says creating a safe school environment requires commitment from everyone involved. He defines a safe school environment as one free of fear from drugs, violence, bullying, harassment, where teaching and learning are not distracted, expectations are clear, and consequences for infractions are consistently and fairly applied. A safe school environment also means knowing what to do in the case of an emergency or threat to safety. Students who perceive their school as safe are more apt to be happy and engaged with classwork and friendships, the superintendent concludes.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Jonathan Getz with East County Magazine's People Power Report. Firefighters in the Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District can now put up their boots and relax in comfort when they're not out fighting fires and saving lives. Jerome's Furniture Warehouse has donated 5 reclining chairs for the Julian Fire Station's lounge. Mike Van Bibber, battalion chief at the county's last all-volunteer fire department, thanked Jerome's for their generosity, adding, "Your act of kindness embodies the spirit of community and giving. We are humbled and grateful."
San Diego Gas and Electric Company, or SDG&E, is offering help to federal employees who were furloughed during the government shutdown and who may be struggling to pay their energy bill. The company has announced that it will not disconnect service to any previously furloughed workers until March 10th, 45 days after the longest shutdown in history ended. And if another shutdown occurs, as the president has threatened, the company plans to extend those protections. SDG&E, along with the nonprofit 211 San Diego, have these resources available to help those impacted. Customers who need extra time to pay their utility bill can request payment arrangements for 3 months via myaccount.sdge.com. Through this portal, customers can also enroll in Level Pay, which averages the highs and lows of bills, making them more predictable so customers can plan and budget easier. 211 can refer customers to payment assistance programs as well. You can get referrals by dialing 211 or visit 211sandiego.org. To achieve long-term savings on energy bills, customers are encouraged to take advantage of energy saving and money saving tips and programs at sdge.com. Ratepayers with questions can call SDG&E at 1-800-411-SDGE. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Miriam Raftery with a consumer safety alert. Despite over 90 complaints of BMW luxury vehicles bursting into flames while parked with the engines turned off, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is not actively investigating the causes. ABC News first reported the problem back in May 2017 and called for a federal investigation. Since then, over 30 new BMW fires have occurred, and yet the federal government still has failed to take action to protect consumers, says Joseph Levine, executive director at the nonprofit Center for Auto Safety. BMW has recalled over 1 million vehicles since that 2017 report ran, but ABC found fires have occurred recently among models that are not on the recall list. The company has said it can't find a pattern in the fires. BMW claims fires can be caused by issues other than mechanical defects, including rodents chewing wires, improper maintenance, aftermarket modifications, and even arson. BMW notes that it has 4.9 million vehicles on the roadway, and despite those 90 fires, such incidents are still rare, the company says. But Levine says BMW is not doing enough. Some people who lost cars and even homes due to fires caused by exploding BMWs have said the company told them this had never happened before, when it has, and the company knows it. Others have been pressured to sign non-disclosure agreements. Among the victims are San Diego resident Laura Ohm and her 2 sons, who fled for their lives when their BMW parked in their garage exploded. Their home burned to the ground. She wants BMW to fix the problem. In South Korea, the government has held BMW responsible for vehicle fires over there. The company was fined $9.9 million by the South Korean government, which found that BMW tried to cover up technical problems that caused dozens of engine fires in Korea in diesel-powered vehicles. Levine faults the Trump administration for the federal watchdog agency, the National Transportation and Safety Commission, turning a seemingly blind eye to serious safety problems. He concludes, the only thing keeping BMW's feet to the fire, forgive the pun, is going to be outside lawsuits, adding, that's not how it should work.
¶¶ Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes an owl discovery event, a Lunar New Year celebration, Hawk Watch, a star party, a Celtic dance performance, a star party, a Moxie Theater World Premiere play, Valentine's Tea, Black History Month events, and a mega pet adoption.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including Butterfly Day, a Laurel and Hardy fan club event titled Laughter is the Best Medicine, a Borrego historical tour, and a living history presentation in the steps of explorer Juan Bautista de Anza.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
In honor of Black History Month, Grossmont College's Griffin Grill will host Jazz Kitchen with soul food specials each Wednesday in February from noon to 1 p.m. The event features singers and musicians from the college's jazz vocal ensemble and jazz studies department. For a map and directions, you can visit grossmont.edu.
The Lewis A. Stelzer County Park in Lakeside will host an Owl Discovery Day on Sunday, February 17th from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Learn about the owls that live around the park and how these birds of prey survive and behave. Activities are designed for kids ages 5 to 12. Be ready for a short hike and bring water. An RSVP is required by calling 619-561-0580. For details, you can visit sdparks.org.
Verona Resort will host a Lunar New Year celebration February 5th through the 19th to ring in the Chinese Year of the Pig. Festivities include a parade of lion and dragon dancers, lucky hongbao red envelopes, all-you-can-eat lobster and other dining specials, party people games, and giveaways. You can find a schedule of entertainment and Asian-themed restaurant specials by visiting Verona.com.
The Wildlife Research Center in Ramona continues its presentations of Hawk Watch each Saturday through the end of February at the Beegent Ranch in Ramona. You can arrive at 9:30 for coffee and donuts before the program starts at 10 a.m. in the Ramona grasslands. Charles Gale Band of Wild Wings, his apprentice Spencer, and fellow falconer Cisco will all bring birds of prey to share with the public. Binoculars, a folding chair, and a jacket are recommended. For details, you can visit wildlife-research.org/hawkwatch.
You're invited to a star party for viewings of the night sky through telescopes at Mission Trails Regional Park on February 16th from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Meet amateur astronomer and Mission Trails guide George Varga at the far end of the Kumeyaay Lake Campground's day use lot. Guests will view the planet Mars, the Orion Nebula, and other constellations. Learn more at mtrp.org.
Murphy's Celtic Legacy will be presented by Poway on Stage on Sunday, February 17th at 7 p.m. The show features Irish folklore with dancers and musicians from Riverdance, Lord of the Dance, and Celtic Women. The show is composed by Irish musicians, combining traditional Irish and modern dance with multimedia elements, song, and music performed by a 7-piece band. For tickets, you can visit powayonstage.org.
The Moxie Theater presents Her Land now through February 17th. The world premiere play is all about growing up, growing old, and rocking out to the beat of your own drum. The lead character, Jean, is not moving into a retirement home. She recruits her best friends, all in their 70s, and a high school intern to hatch a bold plan for a utopian alternative. Formerly the domain of a Bruce Springsteen cover band, Jean's garage becomes a stage for a hilarious story about growing into yourself and getting what you want. Find tickets at moxietheater.com.
Julian Tea and Cottage Arts invites you to savor Valentine Teas February 14th through 18th. A romantically inspired menu includes freshly brewed teas, a choice of soups, finger sandwiches and savories, scones, a luscious dessert tray, and more. There is also a children's tea and options for vegetarian or gluten-free menus with advance notice. There are several seating times and reservations are recommended. For reservations and details, you can visit juliantea.com.
You're invited to discover puppy love at Cupids and Canines, a mega pet adoption event at Grossmont Center on February 16th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. The San Diego Animal Support Foundation is bringing in dozens of rescue groups and shelters, offering hundreds of adoptable dogs as well as cats. From Chihuahuas to Great Pyrenees, you'll find purebreds as well as plenty of lovable mutts. And maybe find a new best friend for your household. Details are available at grossmontcenter.com.
Grossmont College will host an open mic festival for Black History Month on February 21st from 5 to 8 p.m. in Building 26, Room 220. The third annual event at Grossmont College will feature poetry, rap, spoken word, and more. Directions are available at grossmont.edu.
The Otay Valley Regional Park will host an Adventure Passport Butterfly Day on Saturday, February 23rd from 9 a.m. to noon. You're invited to join in planting native milkweed plants to help transform the park into a monarch butterfly sanctuary. Gardening gloves are encouraged. RSVP via email by February 16th for the February 23rd Butterfly Days to adventurepassport@gmail.com.
Saps at Sea, the San Diego chapter of the Sons of the Desert, the official Laurel and Hardy fan club, will meet on Saturday, February 23rd at Trinity Church in Spring Valley. The Saps will feature a trio of Stan and Ollie's best short films. This month's cartoon is Hot Cross Bunny with Bugs Bunny. Next is Leave 'Em Laughing with Russ Peck on the keyboard, followed by Three Stooges comedy in Men in Black. And after intermission, the second half will feature Stan and Ollie in County Hospital and Thicker Than Water. The show starts at 7 p.m. For more information, visit the Saps at Sea Facebook page.
Black History Month movie night will be held on February 27th at Grossmont College's Griffin Gate. The film showing will feature Hidden Figures, the true story of three African-American women mathematicians who provided crucial calculations for NASA's space race against the Soviets while dealing with racist and sexist assumptions of white co-workers. See grossmont.edu for a map and details.
The Anza-Borrego Desert Natural History Association will host a Borrego historical tour on Saturday, March 2nd from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. The tour begins at the association's building on Christmas Circle, followed by a tour of Old Borrego, farming and agricultural sites where Cesar Chavez once led the farmworkers' strike, lunch at the Palms at Indian Head, and a tour of Sealy Ranch. In the evening, from 6 to 8 p.m., visitors will enjoy a lecture titled In the Footsteps of Juan Bautista de Anza, followed by wine, cheese, and a living history presentation around the campfire to hear a historical reenactor bring to life a soldier from the expedition talking about his daily life on the historic Explorer's Trail. To register for the program and get more information, you can visit the Anza-Borrego Desert Natural History Association at abdnha.org.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events sections at our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County!
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, from the mountains to the sea.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Amanda Matty, author of A Foreign Affair, A True Story of Love and War, a memoir which chronicles her 2005 deployment to Iraq and how she met her husband, a Baghdad native who served as her translator. My guest's second novel, Voicing the Eagle, is a prequel to her memoir and will be released in 2017. Welcome, Amanda. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin a long time ago with your deployment to Baghdad as a Navy intelligence analyst. What was that job to be like, and what were your first impressions of the land and its people?
Well, I deployed in May, so my first impressions of the land was that it was hot.
Right.
It was very hot. But the people were warm, they were kind, they were welcoming. They were excited for us to be there, from what I could tell, the people that I interacted with. And they were really eager to share their culture with us. They were constantly inviting us to eat with them. So it was a lot of fun, and it felt more like a foreign exchange program than going to war. So I guess I was lucky in that respect. As far as my job, Ironically enough, my official job title was Foreign Affairs Relations Officer.
How ironic.
I worked for the NSA at the time, even though I was in the Navy, I worked for the NSA as well. And I was over there basically working for them. And we were rebuilding the Iraqi National Intelligence Service. Just like most everything in Iraq, the U.S. had just disassembled everything. So we were building everything back up from the ground up. So the intelligence service was one of the things that the CIA and the NSA really wanted to get built back up so that the Iraqis could help themselves, so that they could send actionable intelligence and collect intelligence and send it to their troops on the ground. So we were building that back up. And when I say from the ground up, I mean we went over there and had to start from the basics of teaching them, the new employees, what classified material was, how you're supposed to mark it, how you're supposed to handle it, how you're supposed to protect it, how you're supposed to destroy it. So we were really teaching them everything from the ground up. And a lot of them were new hires because the CIA went in and, of course, hired newbies. They did hire back a lot of the old intelligence officers that worked under Saddam. So there was, you know, some leadership in there and some experienced Iraqis who had worked in the intelligence field before. So a lot of them were newly hired employees with absolutely no background in intelligence work or even government work. So again, we were training them from the ground up, but training them in the intelligence field was kind of just half of the job. The other half of the job was foreign relations. We were there to build relationships. We were there to build trust. We wanted them to look at the Americans as friends, as allies. We were there to help them.
Right.
So part of the job, one of the first things my boss said to me when I got off the plane was, smile, be engaging. We're here to mingle. We're here to build trust. At the time, the U.S. had full control of the country still, of course, but we knew the time was coming that we were going to be handing the reins over to the Iraqi government. And then they would have the power basically to tell all of us, pack up and go home. So what we were trying to do was kind of embed ourselves, trying to woo them, if you will, to basically invite us to stay along, to stay on after they took over control and have us help them. And we wanted them to want us to be there. So that was basically more my job than the actual training them in intelligence. I had only been in the intelligence field 3 years myself. I was no expert. So I was great at foreign relations, though.
But you were using your translator for that, for the foreign relations and for the teaching as well.
Exactly. Because, of course, most of the Iraqis who worked at the INIS did not speak English, and I did not speak any Arabic. I was actually a Russian linguist.
Wow.
And they didn't speak Russian either. So.
No, I don't think so.
So we definitely had, you know, a lot of translators that worked in our specific little department, and Fadi was one of those translators.
And so love happened. I think the thing that strikes me is that we're always drawn to romantic stories, love that grows despite the incredible odds. You know, we love Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story. And so here you are in Iraq. And when did you realize that he was going to be your one great love?
For us, it was actually the cliched love at first sight.
Really?
It really was. I know I'm a hopeless romantic, but here we are 10 years later, 11 years later. It really was. Maybe more so for him, because honestly, I really don't even remember the first time we met, because it had been a whirlwind of introductions for me. It was like my second night in the country. It was my first night working at the building. We called it the building. My boss had taken me pretty much from office to office to office and introduced me to dozens and dozens of new faces. All these foreign names were flying at me.
Right.
I shook a lot of hands. And the translator office was, I believe, actually the last office that they took us to.
Mm-hmm.
So by that time, everything was a blur. Fadi remembers. If you asked him, he remembers our first meeting. He actually kind of had to refresh my memory when I was writing the book about our first meeting.
So what sticks out in your mind as what you remember?
The actual time I knew was only about an hour later after we met. He knew at first as well. When he first saw me, he knew. Something just clicked. And he spent the next hour in his office with his buddy trying to figure out a way to make up an excuse to come over to the American office just so he could see me again, he said. So he came up with something, knocked on the door of our office, and then started chit-chatting with one of my colleagues. His name was Keith, and they were buddies already. Keith had been in country for a couple months, so he came over and struck up a conversation with Keith, and that's really the first memory I have of Fadi. And the feeling, honestly, it's indescribable. It really is. I knew then, he knew then. It was unbelievable. He went back to his office, sat down, and told his buddy, his fellow translator, I'm going to marry that girl.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So the French call that the coup de foudre, the lightning bolt.
That's definitely what it was.
Okay, so you met him, you somehow knew, you had that intuition, he had it right away, and then I imagine that it just continued to grow and to blossom, and it wasn't a very romantic environment. So what were the conflicts, the inevitable conflicts that happened when you fell in love with your Iraqi translator?
Everything in Iraq went pretty smoothly, actually. I was only 22 years old. I was naive. I honestly did not understand how risky of a relationship this was, that it was not going to be looked upon, you know, very nicely by anybody, that my government, the people I worked for, were not going to be happy about this at all. Having worked at the NSA for 3 years, I knew numerous people who worked there who had foreign spouses. So to me, it didn't seem like that much of an issue. As a matter of fact, like I said, when I got there, I was told, these are our friends. We liberated these people there. I thought we were gonna hold hands and sing kumbaya till the end of time. That's what we're supposed to do. So the fact that Fadi and I might be developing a relationship, to me, it didn't seem like that big of a deal.
So when did you know? What was the first thing that happened?
As far as when I knew that,
that all was not going to be well.
That it was not going to go too well.
Right.
Honestly, another lightning bolt. After being in country for 4 months, I was sitting at the office on our base in the green zone at the time. We had a satellite office. And I was sitting at the computer when these two people walked up behind me and said, for your safety, we're ejecting you from the country.
Really?
Yeah. And I was, excuse me? What do you mean for my safety? You're ejecting me from the country. Oh, it's come to our attention that you're having an inappropriate relationship with an Iraqi national. And for your safety, we're going to escort you. And they literally escorted me from the office to my room on base, watched me pack, made sure I didn't have any access to any communication devices, took any cell phones I had, took my computer, took me to the helicopter landing zone, escorted me onto the chopper. A woman CIA agent sat with me. They flew me to Baghdad International Airport, and then that same female CIA agent escorted me onto a C-130 plane to Jordan. And once I landed in Jordan, they did let me go on my own, but they handed me a commercial airline ticket back to DC. When I landed at Dulles, there were NSA agents and Navy personnel from my unit there that escorted me home.
So from your perspective now, if it's not a spoiler, was it for your own safety?
I think they believe it really was.
Mm-hmm.
I was young.
Right.
They didn't know what Fadi's intentions were. But the thing was that ultimately that I found that it was a pretty bad double standard. Had I been a male having an inappropriate relationship with a female, this would have never happened. It would have never been, oh, we're ejecting you from the country and going to escort you home for your safety. For some reason, whenever a female falls in love with a foreigner, they think any kind of emotional attachment automatically, national secrets are going to fall out of her mouth.
Okay, so it would compromise.
Right. Exactly. You know, we're just emotional creatures, and you might not know, but he's manipulating you, and you're too naive to understand it. And of course, obviously, none of that had happened. I knew that if Fadi and I were going to pursue a relationship in the future, that there would be steps that I would have to take in order to safeguard. I mean, the fact that I had a top secret security clearance. Anytime you have a relationship with a foreigner, there are steps and protocols that you have to follow. And I was fully prepared and ready to follow those steps and protocol. So then when I ended up in this horrible mess, I honestly didn't understand. Like, why is this happening to me?
Must have been very upsetting.
It was a really rough year. Let's just say that.
So you found yourself at the center of an international criminal investigation. Tell us a little bit about that at its peak, again, without a spoiler, and maybe what toll it had on your relationship.
Fadi's and my relationship has really never faltered. It did not have much of an effect on our relationship. We were both, of course, stressed to the max over it. Mm-hmm. When I returned to D.C., I, of course, was stripped of my clearance immediately, and then I was stuck in an interrogation room with an NSA agent, an NCIS agent, and a CIA investigative agent, and I was interrogated for 8 hours a day over the course of probably about a four-day period.
Oh.
And they were just, of course, they played the nice, you know, you just might not understand what he's tried to get out of you. And they kept trying to just see what all I had told this Iraqi guy that was manipulating me and that I didn't know who he was. And so they were trying to definitely, I think, make a name for themselves. They were going to be the heroes that nabbed, you know, the espionage girl.
Did you ever doubt him for one second?
Never. I knew him from the moment I looked in his eyes. I knew who he was and what he was. But I can see from the outside looking back. I mean, yeah, definitely. I totally understand. However, they did try to railroad me. They, of course, like I said, they used the whole, you just don't understand that he's manipulating you. They typed up my confession and laid it in front of me. Just sign here and all of this will be over. Luckily, something inside me said, don't sign anything. Because in the end, I did later find out that that was basically, that would have been the nail in the coffin for me. That confession that was in that paper would have court-martialed me for mishandling of classified information.
Wow. So how long did this process take?
Almost a full year. I ended up back, I got ejected from Iraq the very end of August. The investigation remained open, clear through until May of the following year. And of course, it was hell for me, literally, because I was looked at when I came back to my command there. I was looked at by all of my fellow sailors as just this awful person who had been sleeping with the enemy.
So you were falsely accused.
Yes, in a sense. I was looked at as I was dirty. I was low. How could you do this? Think of all of your fellow military members that are over there bleeding for this country, and you're over there sleeping around with the enemy who we're fighting, who's killing our boys. Even upper enlisted members of the command would look at me and say things that were not good. I'd have senior chiefs that are, of course, you know, upper enlisted Navy members that would come up to me and say, out of 300 million Americans, you have to choose an Iraqi. Shameful.
So this was a very painful experience. So how did it lead to your exit from the military, and how long did it take for him to come to this country, if that's something that you'd like to share on the radio?
Well, luckily, we both stood our ground. He was being interrogated in Iraq by agents simultaneously as
I
was.
Another painful experience,
right.
I would imagine.
Yes, he was being interrogated over there as well. Then, of course, once they weren't able to get any evidence against us for doing anything that they could legally pursue us, then, of course, they just tried to do anything they could to break us up. They were telling me stories about him. They were telling him all these false stories about me. Oh, you know, when she landed back in America, she went back to her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. She doesn't think about you anymore. It was just all kinds of just games and head games and mind games to do anything they could to break us off. My commander made me sign a no-contact order saying that I would not have any sort of communication with Fadi. And in the end, that was the only thing they were able to get me for, because I did sign that, and then I did have contact with him. I said, you're not going to tell me who I can love. And so, luckily, in the end, that's all they were able to get me for. They did do a disciplinary review board on me for breaking the no-contact order, and it basically was just a chance for everybody to lay into me again about how awful, what an awful person I was for sleeping with an Iraqi.
Well, with all that, I imagine it would have been very, very difficult to get him to come here.
Well, like I said, at the end of the investigation, I was smart enough to seek out a civilian lawyer.
Good idea.
That was completely outside of the military. After day four of these intense interrogations, I mean, even though I was naive and I was young, man, I grew up fast. Mm-hmm. I matured and I did my research real quick and said, something's not right here. I need to protect myself. I'm going to end up in Leavenworth if I don't take some action here. So I did. I drove into DC, pursued a civilian lawyer who was experienced in military trials. And I was being watched, obviously, because literally the next day, the interrogation stopped. The investigators didn't contact me anymore. The case remained open, and they said, oh, we're working on it, we're working on it, we're working on it. I think what they were trying to do is they were trying to drag it out, though, because they knew they didn't have anything on me. I hadn't done anything wrong. So they were like, well, we're just going to keep the investigation open, keep these two apart. Hopefully the relationship will disintegrate. I had about a year left on my enlistment, so they were going to at least keep it open, hopefully till the end of the enlistment. Finally, there was nothing. They couldn't do anything. NSA was the first ones that actually closed the investigation. Like, we've got bigger things to worry about. This girl didn't do anything. So NSA closed it and dropped it. And then when they closed it and dropped it, the NCIS tried to keep it open and keep pursuing me. And from what I hear, rumor, of course, I don't have anything official. NSA basically told NCIS, just get her out of the Navy. Just get rid of her. Stop this. If you take it any further, we don't know what might come out. If you do try to court-martial her, if something has to become a public trial, and we really don't want that stuff out there.
Sure.
She's not worth it. So they finally dropped it. I was called to the legal office on base, and they basically said, okay, the investigation is closed, but we just would really like you out of our Navy. And I said, I'd really like out of your Navy, too, because you're definitely not what I thought you were.
Do you think you would have stayed in the military if all this hadn't happened? Made it a career?
I probably would have. I still have friends from boot camp, you know, 16 years ago who are still in. I follow them on Facebook. I see them in their Navy careers. And it is, you know, like, hey, look what I gave up on, or look what I lost out on. But then I also look at my beautiful kids and my awesome husband, and I think, oh, I won in the end.
Yeah, it really is a fairy tale. It has a happily ever after ending. How often do we get that? And as you state on your website, so I know I'm not giving any spoilers here, that you've got your family now with your two girls, 1 9 and 1 2.
Yep.
So take us to that present day life. What are the joys and challenges 11 years later?
Honestly, I think our life is about as idyllic as you can get. Got two beautiful, healthy little girls. Fadi is an absolutely amazing husband and father. Even, of course, my own family, when all of this started, said, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're marrying. It'll never work out. Marriage is hard enough when the people are from the same culture.
Right.
You're from two opposite ends of the spectrum. You're from two different worlds. This will never work. And of course, you've got people calling you, I knew someone who married a man from the Middle East and he stole her children. And another one married a man from the Middle East and he beats her. And it was just amazing. This is just coming out of the woodwork. And I had no idea, you know, how much, you know, bigotry was within my own family.
Did they turn around your family?
Oh my gosh. They did a complete 180. Mm-hmm. They love Fadi. Fadi's amazing. My dad, of course, was one of, you know, he's a Southern, you know, good old boy. And when he heard that his daughter was going to be marrying an Iraqi, it was not a pretty sight. He and Fadi are like best friends now.
That's great.
It's amazing. They love each other.
Are there any cultural, maybe not conflicts, but cultural differences that come to the fore now?
Another irony, of course, one of the first things people ask me when they discover I'm married to an Iraqi, did you have to convert to Islam? How was that? Are you raising your children, you know, Muslim? And the first thing it's like, yes, I actually did have to convert to Catholicism. I was raised agnostic, and Fadi is actually Catholic, born and raised Catholic. He's one of the 3% Christian minority in Iraq. So I actually did convert to Catholicism when we got married.
It's interesting how we make assumptions based on very limited knowledge.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, you have another book that's upcoming in 2017, Voicing the Eagle, and I understand that it's Fadi's story as a young interpreter for the U.S. military. Would you like to give us a teaser?
Sure. I'm probably more proud of writing his story than ours. Fadi has an absolutely amazing story. He has done so much for this country and, of course, in his country in turn. He was literally taken right off of his neighborhood street to become a translator.
That's amazing.
Right after the fall of Saddam, a couple of weeks after, you know, the liberation of Baghdad, a U.S. convoy rolled into his neighborhood. He mm-hmm. was an upper middle class college boy. He was attending mm-hmm. the University of Baghdad, majoring in English. And the neighborhood he lived in was known to also be where government officials in Baghdad lived as well. So it was a hot spot for the military at the time. They were going in, going house to house, making sure there wasn't, you know, anybody stockpiling weapons. Of course, they were still looking for the weapons of mass destruction. Right. They might have been in somebody's backyard at the time for all they knew. So a convoy rolled into his neighborhood, and leave it to us to roll into a neighborhood and forget to bring anybody who speaks the language. The convoy had nobody with them that spoke Arabic. Pretty much nobody in the neighborhood spoke English. They're going house to house, residential houses, clearing them with weapons. They're patting down the women.
And without language.
Without, they're not able to communicate, of course. And of course, the soldiers, they weren't doing anything wrong
right.
by our standards. But of course, they were, you know, looking at the women. They were touching the women to the Iraqi men there in Baghdad. It was not appropriate. There was tension building between this unit and the residents. And of course, everybody standing outside their front door, looking at the military, the Americans, you know, going house to house. So it's this big spectacle. Right. Body's seeing it happen. He's seeing the tension building. The commander of the unit, an army captain, he saw the tension building. He knew things were not going to get pretty. Of course, everybody's armed. The Iraqis all have AKs in their houses. The last thing Fadi wanted was a firefight in his neighborhood between the Americans. And the army captain literally started walking down the street screaming, "Does anybody here speak English? Does anybody speak English?" He was desperate.
And he stepped up.
And Fadi, he didn't want to. He really didn't want to. He's like, "Oh, I don't want to get in the middle of this." But he knew that it was his duty. He knew nobody else in the area spoke English.
The reluctant translator.
He was the reluctant translator. Yeah. Maybe that should be the name of the book. So he went, he helped that unit for that day clear the neighborhood. And the captain looked at him and said, "You want to work for us? Because we'd really like you to come work for us." So Fadi said, "Sure." For the next year, he worked with that army unit in Baghdad, and then he went on to work for marine units throughout Al Anbar province. He was present for the Battle of Fallujah after the horrible Blackwater murders. He's been injured. He's suffered several combat injuries. He helped translate for the drill instructors in Ramadi who were training the new Iraqi army, the American drill instructors, you know, when we were training them. And then, of course, he worked his way up to the INIS. And along the way, he suffered a broken arm after his Humvee he was riding in was struck by an RPG and flipped. He was actually shot in the chest he took an AK-47 bullet to the chest. Luckily, he was wearing body armor, mm-hmm. but it still results in a pretty nasty injury. So, I mean, he spent years fighting alongside our Marines, our soldiers, leading with them, befriending them. He was, you know, he's probably one of the few people who can say he wore a Marine and Army uniform in Iraq. And of course, this all happened before we had met. So fast forward a few years when I'm being told that I'm this horrible person for being with Fadi.
Right.
After everything he had done for us, for our country, for our military, it was really a big slap in the face.
Must have felt like a betrayal to him.
It was. It felt like a betrayal to him. He understood, though. He does. He even when he immigrated here, we lived in we started off in a rural Ohio town. If he would have to speak Arabic on his cell phone at the local Walmart, he'd get the sideways glances. And I, of course, was right there. I was the pit bull. You know, how dare you? You know, mm-hmm. and he would be the one, no, it's fine. You know, I totally understand. It's not a big deal.
Sounds like a very special person.
He is. He really is a special person. He's one of those people that could go anywhere.
Well, with your perspective and the peaceful life you're living now and everything that you know and you've experienced, in your opinion, was it a mistake, the Iraqi war?
This is a question everybody asks us.
Sorry.
No. No, honestly, it's a question everybody asks us. And it's a question that some of the most brilliant military strategists and some of the most brilliant academic minds around the world still struggle to answer. And we don't even begin to think we know the answer. Overall, looking at it, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. You know, from a bird's eye perspective, there are more people suffering in Iraq today than there were before the fall of Saddam. But there were a great deal suffering under Saddam. So do you say that their suffering is okay? When we went in there, our intentions were good. Yes, a lot of people say it, the upper echelons, we only went in there for oil or for whatever reason. Those of us on the ground went in there to help.
Right.
We were there to help. We wanted to help. And we made a mess of it. We really did. But I've learned, I studied political science after I got out. I did get my degree. And looking at it, you know, from that standpoint, you cannot force feed democracy.
Right.
To a society.
Yeah, the question's complicated, the answer's complicated.
Yeah, you can't do it. Revolution really has to come from within. You can't manufacture a successful revolution. And any revolution is going to be bloody. Look at Syria.
Are you employed now or are you a stay-at-home mom?
I am employed. I work full-time as a marketing coordinator for a local travel company in El Cajon. And Fadi works as a real estate agent. We're doing the cookie cutter lifestyle now.
I know.
It's amazing how you can go from working for a national intelligence service to a real estate agent. They're really similar. But yeah, so we're living the cookie cutter lifestyle and we're enjoying it. I definitely think I'm a person that has to work outside the home at least some.
Well, one last question, Amanda. What are you writing next after Fadi's story?
I really need to finish that one.
Okay, one at a time.
One at a time. I really don't have anything right now that I'm currently thinking after that one. I am focused fully on that one. And once that one gets done, maybe something in the future. But as of now, I write stories. I don't sit around saying, oh, what am I going to write next? It comes to me and say, I have to write this.
Okay, fair enough. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more information on Amanda Matty and her books, please visit her website at amandamatty.com. And her last name is spelled MATTI.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine show here on KNSJ. I want to take a moment to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to hear our show, where we report news that matters to people across our region. In an era of cuts to many major media outlets, shrinking local news coverage, and cries of fake news attacking journalists with courage to report the truth, it's important to recognize and support KNSJ Radio. KNSJ gives airtime for original reporting on issues that matter here in San Diego and East County, as well as national news that impacts people here at home. You can donate to help support real news, honest reporting, and inclusion of your community's views and voices at knsj.org. That website again is knsj.org. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewell, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.